You're listening to Connecting Faith, and today we want to see if we can be more intentional about connecting the faith that we hold so dear with those who don't yet know Jesus and have a personal relationship with Him. You know, being ready to give an answer for the hope that we have doesn't just happen without preparation and attention. We're getting some opportunity today on Connecting Faith to get practical approaches and lessons on more effectively sharing our faith with the friends and neighbors who may be skeptical. And to do that, we've asked Rick Matson back in the studio. He's an apologetic specialist for University Christian Fellowship. He served as a staff worker on college campuses for 30-some years, of serving both McAllister College and St. Olaf College in Minnesota, and frequently travels to colleges and universities across the country. And he's also written a great book called Faith is Like Skydiving and Other Memorable Images for Dialogue with Seekers and Skeptics. And Rick, I know you do encounter seekers and skeptics a lot of time, and maybe more of us do all the time too. And it's not simply just sharing four spiritual laws anymore, is it?
No. Post-Christian society means that people don't have a stronger Christian memory of really what Christian principles are. And so the gap, I think, is getting wider between secular culture and those of us who call ourselves Christian. And so more work has to be done to bridge that gap. You can't just walk in and assume, for example, that people even think that the Bible is authoritative or even relevant anymore.
So are there ways that we can actually take a conversation, move it forward, have a spiritual conversation? I mean, starting one is maybe kind of challenging for some people, but then to keep it moving.
Yeah. Doug Shoup and Don Everts have written a book called I Once Was Lost. And that book is a wonderful treatment of how people move from unbelief to belief in these postmodern times. And they lay out what they call five thresholds of conversion. So when you first get into a conversation with someone, the first thing that might happen is that they just learn to trust a Christian. So that's threshold one, is just trust a Christian. And then secondly, they become curious, like, well, there's something about this person that's intriguing. I want to know more. I want to know why they believe. And a skeptic might say, gosh, I would never believe, but this person seems bright enough and they believe. So there's curiosity there. And then the third threshold is them becoming open to change. And that's actually probably the hardest one to go through. Someone might have idle curiosity. They might trust a Christian, but to actually be open to changing their life and their worldview, open to Jesus, that is the one that's hardest to get through. And then fourthly, becoming a true seeker. So number one, trusting a Christian. Secondly, becoming curious. Thirdly, being open to change. Fourthly, becoming a true seeker. And then fifthly, crossing the line. So what's really helpful about that kind of template is if you know where your friend is in their journey, then you can do things that really make sense for that particular threshold. So you wouldn't necessarily assume that just because someone trusts a Christian that they're a true seeker. And you might want to go back and do things that are a little bit more basic than assume they'd want to go to a Christian concert or come and hear a church service or something. They might not want to do that at all. And the five thresholds kind of guide us through that process.
Which, again, I guess maybe takes some of the pressure off us having to think in terms of, well, it's got to be from A to Z. It's just moving, taking the next step.
Taking the next step. That's exactly right. I think sometimes Christians get discouraged that, oh, I didn't share the whole gospel today, or the person didn't come to faith, and we're thinking of days gone by, the tent meetings and so forth in this country. But I think these days it's a lot slower process. People need to think through all these implications, and we need to give the Holy Spirit time to work in their lives and pay attention to what the Holy Spirit is doing in their lives and walk kind of at their pace. Can I say that? Yeah, we walk at their pace and not expect them to walk at our pace. And sometimes it's slow going, and that's exactly what God has called us to do today. Walk slowly with this person. And then when they move forward, we move forward. Don't get ahead of the Spirit. Don't get behind the Spirit. That's the trick here, I guess.
Having that template in mind, has that helped you in your conversations with the students or faculty or friends and neighbors?
Oh, very much so. One of the first things that I do when I get into a conversation is try to assess, where is this person? Like, I'm the detective. That's what evangelism is. It's detective work. It's discerning where God has brought this person. What is God doing in this person's life? And once I zero in on that, then I can begin to say the things and do the things that will make sense for that particular point in their journey. So my friend Tom was a real lawyer and a bright agnostic atheist person. And it just reminds me that this whole endeavor of sharing faith with other people is often done in community. So Tom was attending a Lutheran church because even though he was very skeptical, he was curious. He wanted to be there and see what it was like. And the way he tells it to me, there is this big poster at the Lutheran church. And it's a poster of Jesus. It's a painting of Jesus, I should say. Every time he came around the corner, he would see that painting. And the caption underneath it is, "Who do you say that I am?" And he knew that he had to answer that question for himself. Who do you say that I am? And he finally read Lee Strobel, The Case for Christ, and I had conversations with him, and other people did as well. And so it was great to see Tom go from trusting a Christian in his skepticism to becoming curious and then actually open to change. That was the amazing thing for this really bright lawyer with a philosophy education at Notre Dame. And, you know, he's a real bright guy. And then a true seeker in the end. And then through reading Lee Strobel and having conversations with us, he came to faith out of his atheism. And that was just so good to see walk right through those five thresholds there.
You know, there are often times along the way, maybe most often along the way, there are questions that come up, right, that maybe barriers or, you know, hard questions that we don't always feel prepared to answer. So talk about some of those.
Yeah, you know, one that comes up a lot is, why does God allow suffering? And this is a long topic, and we should spend an hour on it someday. Sure. But I do have kind of an elevator speech on this that can – a few bullet points. One is, we live in a broken world. God allows suffering because we caused it. We're the ones who rebelled against him, and he's allowing the consequences of our sin to play themselves out in our lives. And so he doesn't always just jump in and fix things. We exercised our free will to create a divorce in our relationship with God. You know, what C.S. Lewis calls the great divorce. And then I think there's a developmental model as well. God isn't so much in the business of just snapping his fingers and making all the suffering and evil go away in the world. James 1, 2 to 4, I'll quote it right here. "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance." And then James goes on to talk about the benefits of that. So I think we live in a broken world. God calls us to be ministers in a broken world. I was at South Dakota State the other day. I was speaking at a fraternity, and there's guys there. Some were of faith and some not so much. And I was telling the story of how my wife, Sharon, had some suffering. She had a chronic shoulder injury, and it would just not heal up. And our friends, Michael and Rachel, at church one day came up and laid hands on Sharon's shoulder and prayed, and Sharon was healed that very day after 8 months of suffering through with that thing. And it was just the power of God. And so I was telling this story to the frat boys at South Dakota State. And one of the guys said, "Okay, well, God cares about Sharon's shoulder, but apparently he doesn't care about the starving children in India because he's not doing anything about that." And I said, "No, he cares about the starving children in India even more than he cares about Sharon's shoulder. In fact, Sharon's shoulder is a symbol. It's a sign. It's a clue that God cares about greater ills and greater suffering in our world." Well, as it turns out, Sharon went on a mission trip to India last summer and brought the love and healing of Christ on this mission trip to Hyderabad, India. And I thought that was just a way for the Lord to close the circle there. Anyway, we're talking about, why does God allow pain, suffering, and evil? And it's because of our free will, but he's calling us to get out there in the power of the Holy Spirit to do something about the ills in the world.
Yeah. We're also in a time in our culture where science seems like that's the most important element on campus, right? I mean, that's our new God.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Science has been very successful. It has a lot of prestige in the academy. I guess what I want to say back to the person who says, "Hey, why do I need God if I've got science?" I don't think God is just an explanation. It's a lifestyle. So these are not necessarily two competing explanations. Oh, God did it, or science explains it through natural law. It's not always that. Sometimes it does get down to that. But God is a person that we worship and that we obey, we're in a loving relationship with. And so there's not necessarily a direct conflict with science. Besides, science only tells us about the physical world. It doesn't tell us how to live. It might make some recommendations, but science isn't ethics. It's not morality. Science is experimentation and prediction. And I guess as a Christian, I would just say, Neil, science is a gift from God. Would I rather be an atheist with just science or a Christian with science and God? That's an easy one for me. I'll take both, you know. I have this analogy. It's in my book, The Shrinking Island Analogy. Here goes, Shrinking Island Analogy. We think the island in the water is God, and the water around the island is science. And as the water rises, God, who is the island, shrinks. But the analogy is this. The island actually isn't God. The shrinking island isn't God. The shrinking island is ignorance. And the gift of science is the water. And as the water rises, God helps us to overcome ignorance, helps us understand the world that he created. It's an orderly world, and the gift of science enables us to study it and make the world a better place.
You'll find more great ways to maybe start dialogue with seekers and skeptics from Rick Matheson's book, Faith is Like Skydiving, and other memorable images for dialogue with seekers and skeptics. Rick's an apologetic specialist for University of Christian Fellowship and serves on the McAllister College and Stanislaus College campuses in Minnesota, as well as travels frequently across the country speaking in colleges and university campuses. Joining us today on Connecting Faith, I want to recommend to the other book we referenced, I Once Was Lost. You'll find that a very helpful resource, as hopefully our time together will be great, filled with resources here as we visit here each time when we get together. Rick, good to see you again. Thank you.
Thanks, Neil.